www.thebrownstone.com or 435-709-7888. And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology. It's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning is Jerry Kaplan, author of Humans Need Not Apply, A Guide to Wealth and Work in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Kaplan unpacks the latest advances in robotics, machine learning, and perception-powering systems that rival or exceed human capabilities. Robots that weed, make gourmet dinners, provide legal counseling, have the potential to make our lives so much easier, but not without serious potential problems that are not technical, but are human.
Good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is Michael Fratkin, MD, who will speak with us about telemedicine in palliative care. Dr. Fratkin has just announced a pilot program for a team-based telemedicine-enabled approach to palliative care for patients with serious illnesses. Fratkin said a video conference allows a seriously ill patient in rural areas to skip the hours of time it takes to get dressed and travel to a clinic. Fratkin says the immediacy of video conferencing focuses all attention on the patient and that patient's needs and concerns. By engaging through video conferencing within 15 to 30 seconds or so, the tech aspect disappears and it becomes just like a home visit.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio only in Park City, only on KPCW.
This is Jen Smith. By the time I was 35, I surfed my way up the Pacific coast of Central America.
KPCW turns 35 this year, and we're having one of our biggest birthday pledge drives and bashes from August 17th through the 21st. We're celebrating 35 years of keeping city and county officials accountable with daily local news. Come to our birthday party pledge drive and celebrate community-based journalism. We've got goodie bags to thank you from businesses like Java Cow, Assemble Park City, the Park City Gun Club, and Photo Bird Drone Videos.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Jerry Kaplan, who's the author of a fascinating book, Humans Need Not Apply, A Guide to Wealth and Work in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. And after billions of dollars and 50 years of effort, researchers are finally cracking the code on artificial intelligence. And as society stands on the cusp of unprecedented change, Kaplan unpacks the latest advances in robotics, machine learning, and perception-powering systems that rival or exceed human capabilities. Driverless cars, robotic helpers, and intelligent agents that promote our interest have the potential to usher in a new age of affluence and leisure. But can technology drive the chasm between the haves and the have-nots further? Well, our next guest will help us understand the human complexities to this technical series of achievements. Jerry Kaplan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you, John. Yeah. Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
Hello, Jerry. We're not talking about Terminators with robot armies and things like that. We're talking about a much more subtle type of arrangement with technology. And maybe you can start by just telling us a little bit about what we may see in the way of synthetic intellects or sensors and actuators or forged laborers?
Sure. Well, the issue here is developing new technologies. They're going to have some significant and potentially negative social effects. And so basically what I talk about in my book, Humans Need Not Apply, is some of the basics of these types of artificial intelligence technologies where we're beginning to equip robots with, to speak informally, the ability to see and to hear. And as a result, we can now use these types of technologies to perform tasks that to date required human attention and human labor. So we're going to see a hollowing out of the labor force in a way that we really haven't experienced before.
Yeah. And we and it's happening so quickly, it's going to be more difficult for us to adopt.
That's exactly right. Nothing's new about automation. That's gone on for a long time, and that's the substitution of capital for labor. But the fact is that what I see happening in the laboratories and universities, the research that's going into artificial intelligence, is we're seeing some new and advanced types of, we're enabling new and advanced types of automation. And that's going to accelerate the pace at which people are put out of work or the way in which the labor force changes. Now, overall, that's a good thing because we're generating more wealth and ultimately everything will be just fine. But there may be an extended period of social turmoil in between as people are put out of jobs and don't have the skills that are necessary for the kinds of new jobs that are going to be created in the future.
Right. Lynn and I both live in Park City. I drive around or ride a bike, you know, that sort of thing. But I and I haven't used Uber before, And I was in Boston recently, and I decided, you know, I'm going to check this out. I've heard a little bit about it. And so I had four, five, six Uber rides. And for the most part, the people had been hired in the last, well, probably a couple of months. They were pretty new. They had upgraded their vehicles. They'd put some money in so that they could meet the Uber standards. And they were really singing the praises of Uber and what it could do for them. I don't think any of them knew that like 8 to 10 years from now, they won't be working for Uber.
That is exactly correct, John. You make a very good point. Uber anticipates hiring, I've seen figures as high as 500,000 drivers worldwide over the next few years. But what many people may not realize that in the interest of making taxi travel safer and less expensive, they're also investing tens of millions of dollars in projects to promote automated automated driving, self-driving cars. Now, when you have that technology, that's just as likely to see that 500,000 people put out of work. And that you may be looking at a time horizon for that somewhere in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, those people can get other jobs, perhaps, but it puts downward pressure on the labor market. It puts people out of work and reduces wages. And that's the one of the two main societal problems that we're going to see as a result of developments in artificial intelligence.
Well, from Uber drivers to, you know, as you say, and as we've been accustomed to for many decades now, you know, human labor forces being aced out by automation. Talk about some of the sort of highest level white collar jobs that you'll see going away with the, you know, onslaught of artificial intelligence.
Lynn, you're asking exactly the right question. Sometimes you think, well, these are going to start with the low-level jobs and, you know, the laborers and the people who, you know, pick crops and fields, and that's true. But the broad applicability of developments in artificial intelligence covers an incredibly big, wide range of human activities. And so, for example, as you may be aware, the so-called Watson technology that's developed by IBM, they're tackling the problem of medical diagnosis. So one of the areas that's going to see a significantly increased impact of automation is the medical profession. The same is true. It's already causing significant problems in labor markets for the legal profession. And the issue here is not you take a doctor and you throw him out of the building and you roll in a robotic doctor and he examines you. That's the kind of the mythology that really leads us astray in understanding this problem. What we're talking about is automating a wide variety of the more routine tasks doctors and lawyers and other professionals perform. And what that does is it leverages those professionals and makes them more productive, which, looked at from a different perspective, means that you don't need as many of them, and many of them wind up out of work.
Yeah, good point. Okay. So as you're mentioning the Watson technology, my mind goes to, you know, forever we will hear that medicine is an art, not a science. And if you can just plug in, you know, all of your symptoms, or if a doctor can do that, or if you can do it at home and it spits out this diagnosis, you still need that intuitive part. But you're saying that at least in the short term, that's not threatened. The intuitive part of medicine is not threatened.
Well, actually, I would politely take issue with you, Lynn, if I'm
please do
that on the radio. The main application of this technology will be for more routine kinds of activities. That's
okay,
true.
Yeah.
But medicine is not an art. That's nonsense. It's a science. And the more science we bring to it and the more analytic techniques that we can use to help diagnose people, the better. Now, right now, it's certainly true that the best way to do that may be for a doctor to examine you and use it, that person's his or her experience in trying to diagnose whatever problem you've got. But that may very well be subject to analytic solutions in the future, which are far more effective. And indeed, that's what they find when they apply systems like IBM's Watson. They do a better job on things like planning cancer therapies and discovering new drugs and doing all kinds of other activities. You'd say, well, God, this is all creative and it requires intuition. Well, that's nonsense. It doesn't, and we're much better off developing machines that can do a better job at these kinds of activities than humans can.
Interesting. Can I take issue with you right back at you?
Of course.
Well, and I just wanted to point out, however, that if you're practicing, you know, what is called integrative medicine, then you are looking not just at the symptoms, and you're looking at the whole person, which is kind of what I think I mean by intuitive medicine and maybe being more of an art than a science. You're looking at the whole person in terms of their mental health and physical health and their environmental health and that sort of thing.
I you know, the way you define it, Lynn, you persuaded me.
okay. Well,
if you look at it from that perspective, I think you're absolutely right. The fact is that what a doctor can do that today we don't have machines that can do is to look at the whole patient, look at a much broader context. In fact, if you think about the nature of automation, typically what it does is it's very narrow and it places certain kinds of tasks, but it can do that often far better than a human being can do for narrow kinds of tasks. Whether we will ever have machines that are capable of the same kind of broad understanding and diagnostic abilities of a Dr. House, if you've seen the show.
Love him.
I don't really know whether we're likely to see that. But it kind of misses the point.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean, we don't need to worry about this.
Right.
The truth is, this is going to dramatically affect labor markets for doctors and for people who dig ditches for a living.
Jerry, there are a number of people, including yourself, that I would call futurists that are talking about where this may go. And we, of course, really don't, because every time we try to predict the future, we're typically amazed at what can actually happen. But people look at what some of the futurists are saying, and they say, you know, I'll tell you why it's not going to happen is because computers will only do what they're programmed to do. And that's just not true. I mean, today, machine learning and perception processing systems and those sorts of things, technology is going to be able to take off on their own, be able to do their own learning and evolve on their own over time. Can you talk about that?
Well, John, I totally agree with what you're saying. In fact, I tell the story, the backstory in my new book, Humans Need Not Apply, about where that phrase came from, that computers can only do what they're programmed to do. It's an amazing story. And
right.
If I just try to quickly run this down for you.
Sure.
It was in the late 1950s that there was a first conference on artificial intelligence that took place at Dartmouth. Now, shortly thereafter, a lot of the participants in that conference made overblown claims for what the field might do, and it began to leak out into the popular press, Scientific American, the New York Times. And now IBM was the leading computer company at the time, and their goal, of course, was to sell hardware, to sell computers to people. And they began to get objections from the customers. Word was coming back to headquarters, the salespeople in the field, that their customers were saying, my God, what if these machines take my job? This is all very frightening. And it was an impediment to making the sale. So they armed their sales force, IBM armed its sales force, with this objection by saying, just tell people that computers can only do what we program them to do. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they did that, and they shut down their internal department, that was doing research in artificial intelligence.
Exactly.
Now, IBM has since come around, but the truth is that the types of programming that was being done 30 or 40 or 50 years ago is very different than the kind of programming that's done today. Even when I learned to program, it was do this, then do that. That's how you instructed a computer to perform a task. Today, new techniques in the area of machine learning and neural networking are really very different, because what you do is, instead of telling it how to solve a problem, you give it examples of successful solutions. And the machine itself, the way the programs work, is it learns how, on its own, how to perform those tasks and how to accomplish the tasks that you're trying to program it to do.
Yep.
So the plain truth is, computers are capable of a far broader range of activities and accomplishments than people today realize.
Yeah, I mean, a typical Fortran statement was, if this, then that. It was so specific. And today, you basically say, computer, go out on the internet, find something, figure it out.
That's exactly correct. In fact, Google itself, is a major leader in the area of machine learning. And if you watch how it responds to your queries, your search requests, if you use Google, you'll see that it's slowly adapting and understanding what you want and how you like your results presented. That's machine learning, and that's what they're doing at Google.
If you were just joining us, we're speaking with Jerry Kaplan, who is a technology luminary from Silicon Valley, written a fascinating book, Humans Need Not Apply, A Guide to Wealth and Work in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Well, it seems to me to make sense that Google is now restructured, or will be restructuring, under Alphabet, and will be able to tell Wall Street, or show Wall Street, what some of these moonshot businesses are and how they're developing. What do you think of this announcement?
Well, I think they're just trying to restructure in order to make their company a little bit more transparent. I know that it's sort of this thing in the news, but I don't think it represents some kind of significant change in what's actually, who's going to work there and what they're actually doing there.
Yeah.
I applaud them for doing it, but it's mostly to satisfy the investors in Wall Street, who were getting concerned that they were diffusing and reducing their profitability by diffusing their investments across a broad range of activities. It didn't seem related to the core business of the company.
Yeah, with tons of cash that was disappearing on a monthly basis that was going towards these moonshots, and people didn't know how to account for it.
Absolutely. Barrels of cash.
Mm. Jerry, I want to ask you about this really interesting part of your book where you talk about moral agency and how we program our computers, or if we ever can achieve that. And you talk about moral agency, or, you know, morality, and you compare maybe a computer to a psychopath. And you say, while a psychopath lacks empathy, still they know how to operate within a structure. They're aware of the structure, and they can either choose to operate within it or outside of it. Talk a little bit about how you compare and contrast that with a computer, with artificial intelligence.
Well, it's a great question. In my Humans Need Not Apply, I discuss this issue of moral agency in considerable detail. Now, the cool thing about moral agency is we ourselves have some intuitions or feelings that guide our behavior to social norms and to engage in ethical behavior. But it's important to understand that machines, there's just no corresponding notion for a machine. So as you put it, machines are natural psychopaths. They don't have any of that kind of human restraint that people do. So when we set them to work on a task, they're going to abide by the types of social conventions that people naturally take for granted. As a result of that, with the growing capabilities of these machines, one of the many projects that we're working on at Stanford University, where I'm a lecturer, is to figure out how to imbue computers with the ability to make morally appropriate decisions. And we don't really have good theory about that, but the important point is, just like psychopaths, the machines don't have to be sentient. They don't have to feel what's right or what's wrong. They just have to behave based upon these sorts of principles. So there's a whole new area of programming called moral programming, or computational ethics, that is concerned with how to make this into an engineering discipline, so that the types of machines that we're going to be dealing with will behave in ways we want them to. This is going to become particularly important when we have self-driving cars.
Oh, yeah. Well, you give the example of a self-driving car and say, you know, if you would want to say, you know, there's going to be something that runs out in the middle of the street, and whether it's a dog or an elderly couple or a bunch of children chasing a ball, you know, how will they be programmed as artificial moral agents to choose which one to either save your life and hit or compromise your own life as the passenger of the car? So interesting.
Exactly. And there's some very difficult moral issues that come up in this context. You might think, well, let's just program it to obey the rule. But that doesn't work. Because
no.
If a child runs out in the street to get a ball and you're in your car, you will swerve, say, to the left across a double yellow line in order to avoid that child. Everybody knows that's the right thing to do, and nobody would question that.
Right.
But if you were to program a car that just said, don't cross a double yellow line, it'll run over the child. So these are very important questions, and we can't just leave all of the cases. We need to have a theory and an engineering discipline to figure out how to imbue computers with these sorts of social conventions.
It makes me want to not step inside of an autonomous car just yet.
Except that your life will be much safer inside that car than it will inside that Uber vehicle that John was talking about in Boston.
It'll be safer, it'll be less expensive, and frankly, when you step in your car today, you have ABS brakes, and they're not called robots, they're called brakes, but they're basically making many decisions for you in a microsecond. Every time
Absolutely.
You touch the brakes. Every time you touch the brakes. You know what I got a kick out of, Jerry, was, you know, there's a lot of people behind the scenes that are taking these technologies and they're quietly incorporating them, bringing them into their businesses and what they're doing. And they're not really talking about the technical aspect of the contribution that technology is making. But you mentioned a law firm, Robot and Wong, who... that he's basically saying, hey, listen, I'm using technology. And the name of his law firm is Robot and Wong.
That's true. Of course, he meant it as a little bit of a joke, but
yeah.
He's still a practitioner that uses a lot of computer technology. And I think he was making a good point. Most of the work that's done at law firms largely is done by computers. Mm-hmm. Most of the stuff that lawyers do is routine, drafting contracts and doing leases and things like that. And a lot of that work can be done, can be automated. And
right.
It's affecting the legal profession right now to a very great degree and is causing employment problems for lawyers.
And I hate to quote from books, or I don't hate to, but I don't do it very often, but I'm just going to do it really quickly. Lynn and I are both Alan Turing fans, so I'm going to give you a short Alan Turing quote, and then I'm going to give you, everybody, a Jerry Kaplan quote. So on the original questions, can machines think, Alan Turing said that by the end of the century, the use of words and general educated opinion will have altered so much that one will be able to speak of machines without expecting to be contradicted, thinking machines. And you paraphrase and you take that that original quote and you are saying that you predict within 50 years' time the use of words and general educated opinion will have altered so much that one will be able to speak of synthetic and intellects as alive without expecting to be contradicted. Tell us about that statement and about synthetic intellects.
Well, I use the term synthetic intellects in the book to distinguish it from another term, which is forged laborers, which is basically machines that do things. Synthetic intellects, to me, are just programs that engage in some kind of intellectual behavior. So just as our language has shifted, and this was, I think, Turing's point, contrary to what people think he meant by the Turing test, what he was talking about was that by approximately the year 2000, people would be able to use the word think when it comes to a computer, and they wouldn't think that was weird. And indeed, that has happened. Oh, you know, the computer's thinking about what to do. Mostly we say that when it's just, you know, spinning, doing nothing. So in terms of language shift, I think people will regard these machines that we're going to have within 50 years, they'll think of them as being alive, not exactly in the same sense that animals are alive or plants are alive, but I think that our language will shift in the same way that it has for the term think, so that what it means to be alive will include a large swath of mechanical devices.
Very interesting. Jerry, a quick question before we let you go. Stanford University, one of the best computer science programs in the country. If you know, we think of someone who's coming to a place like Stanford to learn programming as possessing these certain characteristics, perhaps. But how do you think it's going to morph the program, or how has it already? I mean, are you going to be enlisting the support of more touchy-feely, intuitive thinkers who can program artificial intelligence and intuitive synthetic intellect?
The short answer is yes, and actually at Stanford, and it's sure it's happening at lots of universities. The level of integration between people doing engineering work in artificial intelligence and people in the philosophy department, people who are studying ethics, people who are studying what's called human-computer interaction, HCI, people who deal with studying affect, the expression or the recognition of human emotion by machines, there's a much broader range of academics and professionals and disciplines that are slowly beginning to coalesce to make sure that this new technology that we're developing in the lab serves humanity in positive and beneficial ways. And really, I cover a lot of this in my book, Humans Need Not Apply. And if you'd like more detail, I refer you to the text.
Humans Need Not Apply, A Guide to Wealth and Work in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Jerry Kaplan has written a book for the layperson, which not only covers the technology and where it's going, but some of the challenges that we're going to have, including the chasm between the haves and the have-nots, which could potentially widen in the beginning until we figure out how to adopt all of this and to make the social changes required. Anyway, it's a really good read, Jerry.
Oh, thank you very much, John. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
And very best of luck to you on this book. I've very much enjoyed reading this. Recommend it to anybody. And thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Great. It's been delightful to talk to you both.
Okay.
Bye now. And it's Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back to talk with Dr. Michael Fracken about some palliative care and how technology is changing the face of how patients are dealt with during this end-of-life care.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host John Wells. We were just speaking with Jerry Kaplan. He wrote the book, Humans Need Not Apply, A Guide to Wealth and Work in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Wow, that was very interesting. Our next guest, Dr. Michael Fracken. He'll speak with us about telemedicine in palliative care. Michael has just announced a pilot program for a team-based telemedicine-enabled approach to palliative care for patients with serious illnesses. Fracken says a video conference allows a seriously ill patient in rural areas, for example, to skip the hours of time it takes to get dressed and travel to a clinic. Fracken said the immediacy of video conferencing focuses all attention on the patient and that patient's needs and concerns. By engaging through video conferencing within about 15 to 30 seconds, the technology disappears and it becomes a home visit. Dr. Michael Fracken, thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Well, it's nice to have you. First of all, you know, I think of palliative care as end-of-life care, but maybe you could just explain the breadth of what you do in your practice.
Yeah, thank you so much. Palliative care is the specialty of medicine that focuses entirely and globally on the quality of a patient's or a person's living. It's an extra layer of support to the care that they may be receiving in multiple other practice settings. For example, they may be receiving care from an oncologist inside of a cancer center or multiple specialties. Palliative care as an extra layer of support really attends to a person's physical well-being with regard to their symptom control, empowerment with regard to helping them understand the choices that are in front of them, and hopefully to integrate what is often a fragmented experience for a person with appointments here and there with this specialist and that specialist, perhaps not always on the same page in understanding the person with the cancer or the other illness. So we perform an integrative function with all attention on a person-centered view of what's valuable and important as they deal with serious illnesses that may persist for a long time. So to distinguish it, hospice care represents the specialty of palliative medicine that focuses on the last part mm-hmm. of life, that focuses on the care of people once they have either exhausted all the potential benefits of disease-directed care or they no longer desire to interface with all of that sort of stuff like chemotherapy, radiation therapy, trips to the hospital, procedures, pokes, prods, and mm-hmm. laboratory tests and studies. So when they're done with that or there's no longer any benefit from that stuff, that's where hospice comes in, and they have a very robust and inspired wraparound set of services.
Okay, so then are all of your patients facing terminal illnesses or possibly just long-term illnesses, you know, like a cancer where the chemotherapy will go on for years?
Yeah, it's more like that. And, you know, not to be flip about it, each of us are facing a terminal diagnosis of life.
Yeah. Good point.
So people as they get older or people as they face big challenges like this have enormous needs that are not cared for specifically by the disease-directed or technologically-directed healthcare. It's interesting. I'm not really much of a technology guy, which might seem a paradox given what I'm up to. I'm really about centering our service, our care, for people who are no longer under the illusion that they'll live forever, by people who actually are still under the illusion that we are living forever.
Mm.
Right. Michael, welcome to the show. I'm John Wells, and let me ask you, how many people have you accompanied through the dying process?
I would say that over the last 7 or 8 years since I've been doing palliative care exclusively, I've cared for 1,500 or so people and their families as they finish their lives. In a community or a geographic area that contains a population of about 80 or 90,000, mm-hmm. thinking that there's 4 or 5 people who I've engaged with who are still around, that's a pretty big chunk, and that grounds me in a soulful relationship with my community.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and there's so much that you can say about the dying process and about there are so many words that you can use to describe this, but I had the opportunity to watch your TEDx video, which was extraordinary. And
thank you.
And in just a couple of minutes, you basically netted it out for me, which was when the hand wringing stops and the tears continue, but the stories begin, you know, acceptance. and the celebration of life, that's when it all starts to happen on a very positive note. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, when we are smacked in the face with some terrible news, we have, well, I guess I'll say it like this. There sorts out in the world to be kind of two kinds of people that, you know, face such difficult circumstances in their life. There are people that engage with reality on the basis of what's so. They're grounded in reality. They have a relationship with what's really happening to them and the circumstances in front of them. And those kind of people tend to make better decisions on behalf of themselves and on behalf of the people that love them and care for them. They tend to avoid avoidable suffering. There's another kind of person that tends to relate to reality on the basis of what they wish it to be, what they want things to be like. Those people kind of have their head in the clouds. And those kinds of people tend to make decisions that don't necessarily serve their best interest and do find their way towards avoidable suffering. I take care of both kinds. I have more ease and grace in caring for people who are really have their feet on the ground and are looking at the circumstances and landscape in front of them and making choices in their own way, either by rational analysis or by intuition, but on the basis of what's really happening in front of them. Those people do better. I tend to enjoy that a bit more.
Yeah.
The other kinds of people I take care of too, and I find myself sometimes running around in circles with them while they wring their hands and allow their anxiety to drive their decision-making. What's true about both kinds of people is that our healthcare system is so fragmented and so oriented towards technological fixes, duct tape, bubble gum, and bailing wire, that everybody has a lot of anxiety as they move through such a system. And one of the things that my team and I can provide is grounding.
Yes.
The idea that what's happening to them is actually normal and that they have everything that they need in order to navigate it with grace. And my experience is that most people in the last part of their life, as they move closer and closer and then finally die, experience greater and greater well-being.
Mm.
So just a note to our listeners, if you're wrestling with the dying process, or if you'd even like to talk to your kids about the dying process and you can use a little help with that, Google Michael Fratkin, F-R-A-T-K-I-N, TEDx, and listen to his talk. It's pretty good.
Cool. They can take a visit to our website, too. There's lots of other stuff on there. That's resolutioncare.org.
Excellent.
Excuse me, .com. Sorry, resolutioncare.com.
Right. Okay. So, you know, going back to the soulful, to borrow your word, interaction that you have with your patients, I'm wondering, and I suppose it depends on their level of illness and whether or not they're able to come into the clinic, but before you have sort of kicked off this pilot program of teleconferencing, telemedicine, what percentage of the time that you would see patients would you be doing a home visit?
It was a small percentage of time. The structures that I worked within was an outpatient ambulatory clinic. And so rather than me being inconvenienced or having to travel, 8 to 10 people in the last chapter of their life, whether it's months or years or weeks, were getting themselves out of bed, schlepping themselves into the shower, getting themselves all dollied up to go to the doctor, as some people do, get into their wheelchair, get out into their car, get their wheelchair in the trunk, get their car on the road, park in the parking lot, pull out their wheelchair, get in the wheelchair, roll into the waiting room, get handed the ubiquitous clipboard, deal with this snotty front desk staff, and then deal with a doctor who's frazzled and late, who is looking at them over their right shoulder while documenting at point of care in their computer system. And then the whole thing reverses to get them home. It's an all-day affair for those individuals. It may be convenient in some fashion for the doctor or the provider or the system of care, but it's a burden in a huge way. It turns out that people in the last part of their life, last year of their life, cancer patients have an average of over 150 visits for doctor's appointments, episodic care in the emergency room,
wow,
labs, x-rays, all the rest of it. In the last year of their life, and most of that structure is centered around stakeholders other than the person at the center of the cyclone. And so what's different is that I can see 8 to 10 people quite easily in a combination of home visits and in a combination of virtual house calls using the video conferencing platform that works.
Fantastic. It's funny, as you were talking and describing getting ready for the doctor visit, I was thinking, you know, there must be some element of it's makes people feel sort of good to be able to throw it together and get out of the house and have a little outing. But then when you said 150 visits in the last year of their life, I went, oh, aha, that's why you're doing what you're doing with telemedicine. And so, but again, it makes me wonder about, no doubt you deal with a lot of elderly people. You know, my mom finally learned how to turn on a computer, and now we're really working hard to get her to, you know, do Facebook and that sort of thing. And so talk about coming up against that, and you yourself say you're not a real techie person.
I mean, compared to your mom, I bet I'm a pretty techie person.
Yeah, exactly.
But the truth is that most people are hesitant, whether they're young or otherwise. Not everybody has had, you know, easy interactions with video conferencing, even if they're techie. The prior platforms, Skype, GoToMeeting, and the rest of them are clunky, require specific addresses, some complicated downloading, and then too many darn controls on the interface. We use Zoom video conferencing, and that is the technological innovation that gave me the aha moment. When I first used Zoom, it was seamless, intuitive, as simple as an email sent to an individual and a click on a link. And poof, there we are in a relational space together. Most people are reluctant, they're hesitant, but after, I may have overestimated that in 15 to 30 seconds, the technology always disappears. But by the time that first encounter is complete, the technology has disappeared, and people are having their own aha moment, like, wow, this works, and I'm sitting on my couch in my fuzzy slippers with my cat on my lap having a doctor's appointment. That's wonderful. So most people overcome it. There's been a few elderly people with some cognitive challenges that even with support from our team on the ground with them or their caregivers, they just didn't like it or didn't feel comfortable with it. But I'm going to say greater than 95% of people have been a bit surprised by how well it works and satisfied to a very high degree once we work it through with them.
Michael, I want to add to when you were talking about the process of getting to the hospital, physically getting to the hospital, that many folks in this country live in very rural communities, and they may have a 2.5 or 3 hour drive to the hospital, and you know, it just makes it difficult.
Oh, it makes it
or impossible.
Horrendously difficult. And the idea of going to a doctor, like a palliative medicine doctor, that's been described in variable ways that they probably don't understand, or has been described in ways that associate it purely with death and dying, that's a pretty hard barrier for a lot of people. Since we've been at this in January, we've done a bit over 200 encounters, and on the back of the envelope, we've estimated we've saved somewhere between 12 and 15,000 patient driving miles And you can extrapolate that for how many hours of time and how much difficulty they had in getting ready to go. I've put on a few miles in my car, but I'm in pretty good shape, and I drive a Prius, so I get good mileage and all the rest. But that's a big contribution to the lives of people who are going through such rough times.
My career was based in technology, and I was traveling all the time. I was always on an airplane, and the promise of teleconferencing, video conferencing, telepresence, whatever the buzzword was at the time, was always so alluring. And the first three times that they really tried to make this happen technologically, it fell flat on its face because there was too much hesitation between the conversations. You know, a conversation needs a certain cadence, needs a certain flow. And when you have, you know, all these different people together and you're trying to get creative and trying to work out problems, it just wasn't very good. But I think they finally got it right. And there are technologies out there that are high resolution that doesn't have the type of hesitation so that you can have that cadence and that flow. And you can feel, as you said, within a certain amount of time, as if you're not really, telecommuting, but you're actually there having a conversation, working on something.
That's exactly right. I mean, when I first launched this model, I was planning and budgeting to get a big pipe, a T1 line or a fiber optic pipe for the bandwidth that I thought I would need to run conferences that can include as many as 25 or 30 people, either for the business elements of what we're doing or for the clinical work that we're doing. And what I discovered was that the very lowest tier cable internet connection is perfectly adequate for that because all of the heavy lifting is happening in the cloud, whatever
right.
that is.
Yeah.
And so so for those that are tech interested, the specifications are we have a bandwidth of 1.5 MBS going up and 1.5 bandwidth going down, which is less than many residential standard commercial internet connections. So I saved about an estimated $400 a month because we didn't have to put in a line.
Mm. Sure. And, of course, the people at the other end don't have to have the sophistication either. They can work off of what is provided by a high-speed modem.
And also off personal hotspots run on their cell phones. We've solved problems like that. We have people on satellite internet connections since they're far out. That works. We work with phones, tablets, any brand. It's a very smooth and easy-to-use platform, and most of our IT support happens from Leanne, our office synergist, who's on the phone with folks testing it and making sure that before the encounter they understand what to do and it all works smoothly. And so we've done it on phones. We've done it with a couple of dots of signal on a phone signal, and it works quite well. It's not perfect. But it's getting better, actually, in just the 6 or 8 months that we've been using it.
Michael, it's really interesting that, in a sense, you're on a wave of the future using this technology. But on the other hand, you kind of have an old-fashioned practice here because what you're doing a home visit, just like the old days when the doctor would show up at your house, you know, in the last couple centuries. So it's kind of nice.
I'm so delighted that you picked that up in your background work. Yeah, no, the wave of interest in telemedicine as a mechanism for connecting with a qualified provider had a lot of hardware dependence until just recently. It was a high investment, high infrastructure kind of an undertaking. It never really had got traction. Now there's a new wave of telemedicine interest, but mostly it's oriented towards episodic care, things like Teladoc or doctors on demand, ways of getting your sniffle, ear pain, rash handled quickly without having to have much in the way of work absence for $40.
Yeah.
I think what we're doing that's different is exactly what you said. is that what's missing in health, the gap in healthcare that hurts me the most, is that people facing the greatest challenges, the people that are the most vulnerable, experience confusion, a lack of guidance, a lack of those things that the doctor used to do when they brought the black bag. They brought value in the form of relational engagement. They walked around with essentially an empty black bag, but yeah. They brought value in the form of guidance, wisdom, information, and kindness. And palliative care is a place where the traditions of that relationship have a home. And those doctors, whatever they had in their bag, whatever tools were in their environment, they used them in service to that person and their family, knowing that who they were, how they showed up, how they experienced that person, that was medicine too, and really the heart of medicine. So we're excited in these tools that are emerging and evolving and at our disposal to do what doctors and before them all manner of healers have always done in caring for people as they face this part of their lives.
Right. Michael, just a really quick question. We're running out of time, and it's probably a much bigger question, but I know you're based in Arcata, California, up there in Humboldt County, and the whole medical marijuana question, I feel like here in Utah, it's going to come before the legislature. It's going to be passed in one of these next very recent, or very soon it will be. Yay, nay, thumbs up, thumbs down. How has it changed the culture there in Humboldt County?
Well, in the 30 seconds we have left, I probably can't answer all those things, but what I can say is that traditional healers have been using the plants in their environment to provide comfort and ease to people without a strong evidence base for many thousands of years. My experience here is that thoughtful use of cannabis products by people with a whole lot of symptoms can make a big difference and sometimes reduce the amount of pharmacologic medicine or medication that they take. It's variable, but with some simple principles like start low and go slow to find a titrated dose of a medicine. It can help things like pain, anxiety, and things like that. And I tend to recommend CBD-rich strains or tinctures as a way to effectively find out what's the right dose for each individual.
Okay. Great answer.
So I'm in favor of more and more information and very thoughtful use of these medicines to improve the quality of life. If they improve the quality of life, I'm happy.
Well, maybe we can have you back on the show, Michael, when medical marijuana becomes approved here in Utah. We'll look forward to that conversation. Dr. Michael Fradkin, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for all of your thoughtful answers.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. And once again, I just invite the community to join our community at resolutioncare.com.
Okay. Sounds great. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Bye-bye, John.
Bye.
Thanks, Michael.
And that was really interesting. Palliative care, what a fascinating job he has. We'll be right back. It's Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Hi, this is David Jensen, the director of the Habitat for Humanity Restore in Park City. As our daily customers know, every visit is a new adventure since we receive beautiful furniture and building materials from local donors every 10 minutes. And your purchase helps families in our area. Check out our popular Facebook page to see more. And as always, the Restore is open.